to this congregation guest preachers to occupy our pulpit. This morning we have such a guest preacher. I find myself, however, slightly embarrassed, diffident about the introduction of this guest preacher. Pride would have me say I'm afraid too much, and perhaps modesty too little, so that I will content myself just to say that I am very, very happy indeed to have my pulpit occupied this morning by Rabbi Daniel Jeremy Silva, who will preach on the theme, A Question Most Frequently Asked. Rabbi Silver.
Dr. Silver, I was in a similar position last June. We invited your illustrious rabbi to the concluding service of our religious year. He spoke with his usual brilliance. But I remember one or two days after the occasion, one of my congregants came up to me and said, Rabbi, you know that preacher that you had for us last Friday night? He speaks with so many of the same intonations and tonal qualities that you do. I wonder if perhaps he hasn't been listening to some of the tape recordings of your sermons. The only theft of that type, I think, took place when I sat not so many years ago in those rows up there where the high school class now is. I had the opportunity to listen to the magnificent words that were uttered from this pulpit. But before we begin our sermon, I must admit to you a piece of pious deception. The bulletin announced that my topic was to be a question most frequently asked. Actually, I'm going to speak on this theme, is there any hope? And the reason for the deception is this. Several weeks ago, I was invited to appear before the staff and the school body of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Chicago. The theme that was assigned to me was the need for education. The next morning, the Chicago University Maroon came out with this headline, Rabbi Silver's speech shows need for education. I simply could not see the front page of the Temple Bulletin reading, this Sunday, guest preacher, Rabbi Daniel Jeremy Silver, is there any hope? To our theme, then. As you know, I occupy a pulpit in a congregation which is both young and new. We have made great progress. In many ways, our beginnings are exceptional. And yet, you cannot preach in a rented church hall on a Friday night and occupy this magnificent structure the following Sunday morning and not feel in your heart a bit of pain of envy. We cannot do away with the temporality, the insubstantiality of our structure. The pulpit, the ark, all is of necessity removable. And it has none of that massive dignity and simplicity which this, possibly the most successful achievement of American temple architecture, can offer. And yet I think that behind the diversity, there is a unity. We share together the common symbols of our faith. And it is with one of these symbols that I would speak to you this morning. It is a symbol of the eternal light, that light which shines behind the head of every speaker from every temple pulpit, that light which burns as a symbol of our Jewish confraternity. It binds us together in common unity and common cause, and it roots us together in a common tradition. The light, they say, was first kindled by Moses at the foot of Sinai before the first temporary tent of meeting ever occupied by Jews for worship. It has been lit and sustained in every community, wherever and whenever Jews worshiped, and to sustain this light and to keep it lit was never easy. Many have been the winds of hate which have been unleashed by the cruel hatred of mankind against this light. And sometimes, in some communities, they succeeded in extinguishing it. Sometimes it was snuffed out. But always, always, somewhere else, in some other community, the light was sustained. There was someone else to keep the light. The swords that have been raised against that light have long since rusted and dulled. The light burns on, inextinguishable. This symbol, the basic symbol of our continuity, the symbol of our eternal hope. I would suggest to you this morning, as a theme of my subject, that hope is a necessary, integral part of our Jewish religious life, of all life. Indeed, there can be no successful life without confident hope of today and of tomorrow. And I suggest that the presence of this light in our sanctuaries reminds us that there is reason to hope, that hope is reasonable. Think of it. The Jews have, wherever they have been, constituted a minority, most often a despised minority, a minority which many sought to erase and efface from the face of the globe. But we are here, and increasingly the preachments and teachments of our faith are being put into practice by the nations and peoples and individuals of our world. It stands as a constant reminder to us, as the visible presence before us, of the reasonableness of hope. And I think there is a significant lesson in this. Dr. Abraham Sacker, the president of Brandeis University, once wrote a history of the Jews which he entitled, "Sufferance is the Badge." Well, sufferance may be the badge, but hope, faith, optimism is the banner on which Jews have always faced the slings and arrows of whatever outrageous fortune life held in store for them. When Dr. Heinrich Goetz, in the last century, set about to write his many-volumed history of the Jews, he sought to find in it the single strand that could express all that he felt about the spirit of the Jew, that could perhaps unravel for a moment the riddle, the mystery of Jewish survival. And when he had written this detailed history of the Jews, he told the world that he had found that strand. He had found it in a sentence from one of the poems of our Book of Psalms, "Rabat tzraruni min urai, aflo yochluli. Much have they afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. Despair is not in the vocabulary of the Jew, else the Jew would not have survived. For though weeping may tarry for the night, joy will come with the morning. The dark blackness of the murder camps of Europe turns inevitably into the light and the hope of a reborn, renascent Israel. 100 years ago, somewhat less, there seemed to many to be no future for the Jew in Europe. Some began to dream of creating a new home, but they had no program. They had no status. They had little community support. They had only a dream. How could they approach the nations of the world, a few individual Jews, and ask for Jewish rights to Palestine? How could they tell the Jews that now was the time to get out and to build anew the Holy Land? If a gambler had taken odds on the success of the early Zionist movement, the odds would have been astronomical, and there would have been no takers. And yet Herzl found the key to success when he said to the first conference at Basel, "If there is the will, the dream will come true. If we believe it, we can accomplish it. Though enemies compass me about, yet will I believe in him." Such is our hope. Such is our hope for the future. Such is the nature of the Jewish attitude towards life. This attitude is written deep, my friends, in our psychology, in our theology, in our philosophy. The Jew looks on man not as a small, depraved, fallen creature, but as a person capable of infinite power, sufficient power to cast down the idols of evilness, the false gods which the world raises up against us. We are not too small, too little, to make this world into a fine world and to make our lives into successful lives. Read through our Bible. You will find in it men who sin, men who commit error, men who are evil. But you will never find in our Bible the biblical characters depicted as small, insignificant, hollow men. You will never find our Bible depicting human life as being less than capable of achieving its own salvation. There is great insight in this. It means that our forefathers knew full well the baser instincts which surge within the human breast, that men are selfish, that men are evil, and sometimes savage and cruel. Long before Freud, our ancestors knew this. But they also knew that within the soul there surges a life-giving, love-giving instinct as powerful, as strong, as instinctive as the urge, the will to survive and to be selfish. They saw human creativity. They saw the human being's capacity to give love and to receive love. They understood the human need to respond to beauty and, when possible, to create that which is beautiful. They saw the slow determination of the human race to raise itself from savagery and from brutality, and to achieve culture and civilization, to change warfare into peace, hatred into love. They saw man's instinctive need to live together in community and in cooperation. And seeing this, they pictured man not as wholly depraved, wholly selfish, wholly incompetent of achieving his salvation, but as a creature of two parts, one the dust of the earth, the other divine stardust. And they placed upon us, because of these two sides of our nature, the responsibility of magnifying the divine and minimizing the dust of the earth. Our theology reflects this psychology. Our theology tells us that just as man is capable of achieving his salvation, so the earth that has been given us is not a veil of tears which we can never improve upon, but a rich earth, a good earth, an earth given to us for the blessing of all men. Rabbis love to help embellish the Bible with tales, with midrashim, which took the essential meaning and brought it across to the people. And as they read through the first chapter of Genesis, they were struck with the refrain which appears after each of the daily creations by God, "Behold, it is good. Behold, it is very good." And they drew and pictured a little drama. They said that in the beginning, God took Adam and brought Adam up to a high place from which somehow it was possible to oversee and overlook the whole earth. And he paused there, and he took Adam by the hand, and he said, "Look, O man, look at the richness of this earth and its fertility and all the fuel and the timber and the rain and all the sunlight and all the hope that I have placed into this earth. It is all for you. If men will it, and if your sons and descendants have the ability to share equitably the richness of this earth, and if they have the insight and the ingenuity to find out its resources and to use them technologically for their benefit, life can be most beautiful for them here. There is all that they need for a good life here on this earth. Only, O son of men, use it wisely." This is a refrain which you find constantly in our faith. The good earth, the earth placed, given to us for man's benefit. The earth which was created and destroyed 70 times before God found a world sufficiently good and bountiful for the use of man. And also our theology tells us that because this earth is good, we should not concern ourselves with the future life, but we should concern ourselves with making good and making use of all that we now have. We do not know whether there is a heaven. There may be, there may not be. But we do know that we can create on this earth a heaven. We do know that if we have the strength to see our duty, and our duty is quite clear, moral responsibility, social insight, a hatred of all cruelty and callousness, if we see our duty and follow it, we can create heaven on earth, a world fit for all men to live in. Now, it is not always easy, and men are not always able to see the richness of this world. Many of you, I'm sure, know the story of how the cathedral in Florence was built. It was to be the most magnificent church of its day. To build it, the architects imported marble and semi-precious stone from all corners of the earth. And only those marble pieces which met the most rigid inspection were allowed to go into its construction. And many pieces were thrown away, cast aside into a refuse heap. They had not always the capacity to see in the stone the beauty that could be made from it. And it remained for a man who had that genius to walk by this refuse heap and to see in the grain and the quality of a piece of marble the final statue of David. For this man was Michelangelo. And the marble, the piece of marble which was cast into a refuse heap, became probably the most perfect statue ever created by the hands of men. It is not always easy to see the potentiality, the bountiful plenty of our earth. It's not always, you cannot look at a forest and see the timber and pulp unless you have eyes for it You cannot look at the hills and see the rich veins of iron or of coal which may be inside of it. We need to be trained. We need to be trained to see the richness of the earth and the hope that it therefore provides for us. And strangely, our tradition, at least in its most orthodox and ancient forms, provided a means for so training us. I was made aware of this last summer. As I traveled through Israel, I was taken about by a middle-aged German guide. And whenever we came across a scene of great beauty, whenever we saw immigrant children learning to play together in happiness in the sun, growing strong, whenever we saw new construction on old desolation, he would pause, and before he would comment on what he had saw, he would utter a short prayer. Praised art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has so enriched my life with meaning. He did this everywhere. When we stopped to eat, when we came to a fountain and stopped for a bit of cool water, on his return home, when he entered again the warmth of his family. Here was a man who knew how to count his blessings. Here was a man following an old Jewish practice which teaches us to count and to number our blessings. And I could not but think how much richer this man was, this trained musician who is now driving a tourist taxicab in Israel, how much richer he was despite all the frustration his life had seen than so many I knew in our own rich land of plenty, who, surrounded by all the luxury, all the richness which life has ever been able to provide for any one group, can see not their blessings, but only the petty difficulties and troubles which bother us during the day. This ability to count our blessings, to see that the bothers and the troubles of life are balanced and well-balanced generally by hopes that do come true and by joys that can be realized. This ability, I think, is the key and the secret to Jewish survival. It is certainly one of the fundaments of our Jewish tradition. And here, as in so many other places, we stand diametrically opposed to the major face of our earth. When I was in Japan, a Zen Buddhist priest, a small, head-shaven, clear-eyed man, used to come into our office, and we discussed at great length our respective face. And I will never forget one day, as we were talking about religion, he glanced out the window, and against the side of the building he noticed a ladder which had been left there by some departing workman. He told me, "Chaplain, this is the difference between our faith. Your faith looks on life as if men were climbing up the steps of this ladder. The bottom rung is the primitive savage. The top rung, the messianic age for which you dream. And mankind is now struggling to climb up the rungs in between. Take this ladder from the wall. Place it along the ground. And you will understand how we look on life. We feel that there is no essential difference between one generation and the next. Life is a horizontal movement of birth and rebirth. There is evil, and there is cruelty, and there is inhumanity in each generation, and the amounts thereof do not significantly differ. We think only of withdrawing ourselves from life, somehow gaining sufficient insight into ourselves, sufficient inner strength, not to be hurt, not to be afraid of the daily troubles which surround us. We revere the Buddha, for instance, not because he was a social prophet or critic, but because he showed us the inner way, the way which leads to resignation, to inwardness, to self-concern, to stoic resolution. I was impressed He was a truly religious man. And yet, as I looked about the Orient, and as I saw the cruelty and the poverty with which it abounds, as I saw the crying need there for social reform, I could not help but think that somehow a more prophetic, a more dynamic faith, a faith which would spur men to action, was somehow necessary. And this is true also of Christianity. Christianity in its traditional forms emphasizes not the involvement in life, but man's withdrawal from life. The traditionally pure religious life is the monastic life, the life of pure separation. They emphasize Paul's insistence on man's inadequacy rather than the prophetic insistence on man's competency. This is a world which is a veil of tears. The optimist looks on life and says, "How green is my valley." True, Christianity has had many forward-looking spokesmen of a great social gospel. But in its fundamental tenets, it is concerned not so much with works as with faith, not so much with human progress as with personal salvation. Judaism alone preaches this doctrine of hope. And this is a great doctrine, because life without hope is somehow lived in a twilight zone of dissatisfaction. I remember well a young sailor who came into my office in Yokosuka just before he was to be sent back from overseas for discharge. We had a talk about his future. I asked him what he was going to do and what his plans were, and he told me this. He said, "Chaplain, when I came into the Navy, I thought that the GI Bill rights which I would win here would be used to go back to school. When I was in high school, a physics instructor told me, and I think this is true, that I have a great capacity and talent for the sciences, that I should go back and go to college and become a physicist. I dreamt of this. But now I'm not so sure. Life is short. And after all, Chaplain, let's be practical. It would take me 7 years just to get my working papers, 7 years before I could earn a living. In those years, I could hardly think of marriage. I would have to work long hours after school to make ends meet. Why bother? I can go home. My father owns a store. He can give me a good job. I'll live a few years well. I'll be able to enjoy now the good things of life. Why should I gamble on 7 years of work? After all, Chaplain, in 7 years, the world may no longer be here. My sacrifice may be in vain. I'm going to take the good things of life while the taking is good." When men lose hope, when men cease to dream great visions, then I suggest that life somehow becomes constricted. And the very broad satisfaction that they seek in life will be incapable of achievement for them because of their narrowness and the constriction which surrounds their lives. And I had this proven to me in an interesting way. Last summer, 5 of the young people who went through high school here with me were sitting with me on a back porch discussing all the grave problems of the world. And I remember that all of them were complaining. Cleveland didn't have enough of the social opportunities and of the cultural advantages of the big city. Somehow there was a gnawing dissatisfaction in their lives, and they were venting this dissatisfaction and placing it upon the community rather than upon their own selves. And as I looked about, I think I caught a glimpse of the problem. To my right was a young doctor. He'd wanted to go into research, but his father-in-law had had a good medical practice, and he was now spending his working hours with his father-in-law. There was a young attorney. The young attorney was also in his father's office. I remembered that in the days when he had dreamt, the young attorney had wanted to teach. And then there was a young businessman, a man who had been and was becoming remarkably successful. But when we had talked in high school, he'd wanted to teach. He'd wanted to teach or to go into social work, to be with people, to work with people. But that somehow, he told me, his fiancée and his mother felt that teaching was not a sufficiently lucrative profession for a man of his talents to engage in. And so he was now in business. And so it went. Each of these men had, in the name of prudence, in the name of common dollars and cents, sacrificed some of his dream. And somehow, because he had done this, life had lost its luster, its aura. It was less complete and less satisfying than he wanted it to be. And this is true even though each of these young men had all that we normally associate with the good life: social acceptance, happy families, good homes, economic security. No, you cannot live life by standards false to you, to your inner light, and sit and believe that you will be able to transcend the twilight zone of dissatisfaction which must inevitably surround you. That is why Judaism preaches hope. And that is why Judaism seeks to make you set your sights high. Dare the impossible. Attempt. Try. It was impossible for the Jews to dare to preach a new testament to the world. And yet they did. It is impossible when you look back on history to believe in Jewish survival, but we are here. It is impossible to believe that the state of Israel could ever be created, but it exists. If you have the will, almost nothing is beyond realization. Now, it is today very common to hear people adapt a cultured fatalism. I don't know how many times I've heard in sermons and speeches T.S. Eliot's testament to his own inadequacy quoted. This is a generation of hollow men tilling a spiritual wasteland, and the only constructive, courageous act which we might do would be to die. This is an age which believes that the Kafkas and the Joyces have depicted all that there is of life, that life is mean, that life is callous, that the true life, the true inner life, is reflected in the casebooks of the psychiatrists rather than in the preachments of a faith. And there have been those of our philosophers and of our theologians who have attempted to preach to us a doctrine of fatalism and of despair. The Niebuhrs and the Barthes and the Bubers have told us that man is inadequate to his life situation, that we should not dare because we cannot do, that we should not dream because we cannot accomplish, that we are fallen, inadequate creatures, that the best we can ask is to confront our God and through prayer and self-analysis prepare ourselves for life everlasting, or at least for a self-contained spiritual life in this world. It seems to me that these philosophers are very much like the gentlemen from the Department of Defense who not so long ago were cautioning Americans to build concrete bunkers against air raids in their backyards. Our solution to the world's problems is to withdraw ourselves from the world, to shelter ourselves by 3 or 4 feet of concrete, as though this will solve our problems. No, you must dare. You must do. And I suggest that these well-accepted preachers of today look at only half of the picture. They are not true to the totality which is man and which is human life. They tell us, for instance, that if we look at the univax and at automation, we will see that machinery can outproduce man, can even perform calculations beyond our human capacity. They say, look then, how insignificant man is, how small. A machine is more than he is. Why think big? But I suggest that they forget that these very machines were created by men, that these machines cannot create beauty or art or music or any of the non-mathematical and logical mental processes. I suggest further that these very machines are bringing about an age in which men can, for the first time, live a life that is fuller and richer than mere physical work. I suggest that these machines are bringing about a world in which the 9/10 of the world, which is underprivileged, can hope for a life with some measure of happiness and fulfillment and some knowledge of the luxuries of recreation and of peace of mind. But they say, look at the atomic bomb. It poses a daily threat over your lives. You cannot control it. Resign yourselves to it. Live as best you can under the threat. But this very creation of ours also has given us a new source of energy. It also has taught us to use more fully all the natural resources of our world. It also has brought about a growing speediness of transportation, which has knit our world closer together, made it more interdependent, made us more aware of our common bonds, made us more aware of the fullness which each of us shares in life. No, I think this is an age of great promise, not only fraught with great difficulty. It is an age in which men have every reason to hope. Never before has mankind had it within its capacity to raise the standard of living of all men, not only of the special few. Never before has mankind had it in its capacity to destroy colonialism, to destroy despotism, to make it possible for all men to share an equitable and full portion of life's goodness. The dangers we must meet, dangers we must meet face on. And if we do, the hope will be real. Hope then will unleash our potentiality to face the future. Hope will make us fuller men, more powerful men. Hope alone will enable us to greet the new day with confidence and to say, I know your problems, I'm fully aware of the difficulties. I will do my share, as I am confident others will do theirs, so that the messianic age, the age of peace and of plenty, may truly come. For an age so fraught with potential as ours is to come back in on itself, for an age that has so much potential to stop itself short of fulfillment, is the greatest crime that I can imagine. If we do not dare, these dangers will surely come upon us. Only by daring, only by hoping, can we see that the future will be bright. And let me close by quoting to you a wonderful, somewhat strange, and yet I think pertinent comment from the rabbis. As you know from the Rosh Hashanah and the Yom Kippur liturgy, our rabbis delighted in picturing man before a heavenly court, man rendering account for his life here on earth. And we would think that the questions asked of man by this heavenly court had to do with, how well did you live? Did you obey the moral law, the Ten Commandments? Were you kind? Were you charitable? Were you gracious? Were you helpful? Did you love? But strangely, the rabbis tell us that none of these questions will be asked. Only one question will be asked by the divine prosecuting attorney, and it is this. Hatzipita li Yeshua, in life, were you ever confident of hope? Did you lead your life by the light of an ideal, by the light of your inner ambitions? Did you in your life succeed in fulfilling your innermost talents, or did you thwart them by being overly realistic? As a people, as a member, one of the members of the Jewish people, did you live in hope? Did you see the future greatness of Jewry and the future acceptance of its ideal? Or did you see only the difficulties, the sociological and economic difficulties of being a Jew? And as one of the citizens of your world, did you see the peace, the opportunity, the plenty that it affords all men? Or were you thwarted, were you narrow in your sight? And did you see only the problems, the tensions, the frustrations, which are part of every life? Hatzipita li Yeshua, did you hope? As I think we could all well hope. Hope in the great day when every man can truly sit under his vine and under his fig tree or before his television set, and none need be afraid. Amen.